You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Sorry, I didn't put your mic on, Nita. I put everyone else's mics on, including the mystery studio guest who's invisible.
It's the invisible guest.
So I'll turn that mic off. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning, Sonia and Jesse.
It's Wednesday, and we just had this discussion, the 26th of March. I was thinking it was a couple of days earlier than it really is.
Yes, 2025. We're in 2025.
We're in 2025.
Yeah.
And we were saying it's been a bit of an up and down week for all of us, and hope that whoever you are out there listening, that you've had a better week than we've been having.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in the world, and there's a lot going on generally, I feel, and it's just sometimes a bit hard.
Yeah. That's why 3CR is here, to keep everyone company.
Exactly.
And a experienced or like knowledgeable voice on the air, a friend who understands. Yes.
Absolutely. And to assure you that you're not going crazy. It is that dire out there right now, and we feel it too.
And it was Earth Matters was on just now, and there were some positive things about things that we can do, especially in the context of the upcoming election, to be in terms of climate and environment. And hopefully in a couple of weeks, we'll be having Médecins Sans Frontières, who will also be talking about that in the context of humanitarian. Vote for Humanity will be the next Médecins Sans Frontières thing. So. Mm-hmm. This cool. is the time when the politicians allow us to exercise a minimal amount of power over them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what have we got coming up today?
Well, today we hope listeners like Cuba, because
this is
the Cuba show today. But actually it might be interesting to hear a couple of different perspectives. I think they're going to be different perspectives. But before Cuba,
We will play a conversation that I had with Uncle Robbie Bunjalini Thorpe on Bunjil's Fire last week. And this is a conversation that I guess concerns the current treaty process, which is being conducted by the so-called state of Victoria, which, yeah, I guess in summary, is a sham. So we talk about that, and hopefully we'll get a chance to play Treaty by Yothu Yundi after that. That will be our first segment.
Yeah.
And then we'll be talking, the first of our two Cuba segments, we'll be talking to Bob Price, who's joining us from the States. They have authored a book called Cuba, A Socialist Dream Deferred. And so they will be talking to us about socialism in Cuba. And that will be the focus of what they'll be talking about, or the lack of it, or the midway point of where it is. Then after 8 o'clock.
And then after eight, we'll continue chatting with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis about Cuba. So listeners might be familiar with Sasha. He is the co-host of the Latin American Update program here on 3CR, as well as Unitarian Half Hour, and is extremely knowledgeable on all things Cuba and Latin America.
And hopefully listeners have been tuning in for the last couple of segments last week and the week before.
Yes, and I think I've figured out how I can put a whole recording on that people can access, listeners can access. So
excellent.
I'll try and do that, so that way if you do miss it and you do find it interesting, then there'll be a way to listen to the rest without having to go back to all the different Wednesday breakfasts
excellent.
On the website. Yeah.
And that will be it for our show for today. But first up, we've got the news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't.
sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now. Yeah.
And these are the news headlines for this Wednesday, the 26th of March, 2025. It's 7:05. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast, and we're beginning in the Northern Territory, where the Central Land Council fiercely opposed proposed changes to the Northern Territory's Sacred Sites Act on a couple of days ago on Monday, accusing the country Liberal Party government of bypassing traditional owners in a bid to, quote, streamline development approvals and allow Aboriginal Areas Protection Authority certificate transfers. Minister Joshua Burgoyne touted the updates to the 1989 law as balancing site protection with growth, with a draft bill due by week's end. But the Central Land Council Chair Warren Williams blasted the process as ill-considered and disrespectful, claiming a recent meeting yielded only platitudes, despite demands for details. And Williams dismissed Burgoyne's consultation claims as a cynical tick-a-box exercise, warning the rushed changes threaten Indigenous rights without proper input from Northern Territory Land Councils and their members. With sacred sites at stake, the Country Liberal Party demands a halt for genuine consent, highlighting the overt focus on moneyed interests at the expense of cultural preservation and Indigenous sovereignty in the territory.
And to Peru, where Peruvian Amazon leaders demand an end to oil projects at rights hearing. In early March 2005, Indigenous leaders from the Peruvian Amazon appealed to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, urging Peru's government to halt oil and gas projects they say threaten their land, health and food security, violating international consultation rights. The group cited 831 documented oil spills and risks to uncontacted tribes, with environmental leader Julia Kurishki Palacios rejecting Peru's claim of upholding human rights as out of touch with the reality of environmental harm across the 75% of the Amazon under concessions. The government dismissed most accusations and dodged media, leaving the commission to demand written responses amid growing evidence of deteriorating conditions. Environmental lawyer Cesar Ipenza and Survival International highlighted a worsening crisis, with policies favoring extraction in vulnerable areas and recent deadly clashes involving the uncontacted Mashiapiro tribe near the logging sites. With 21 Indigenous nations affected and no effective dialogue from the state, environmental leaders are leaning on international pressure to enforce treaties that Peru has sidestepped as the fight against exploitation in one of the world's most biodiverse regions continues.
And over to Iran, where Iran's Atomic Energy Organization spokesperson Behruz Kamalvandi announced on March 23rd that Iran is prepared to resume its 2015 JCPOA nuclear deal commitments if other parties honor its rights, amid stalled talks derailed by the US's 2018 exit and sanctions under Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Kamalvandi defended Iran's scaled-back compliance as lawful retaliation after a year's wait, insisting its nuclear program, subject to rigorous International Atomic Energy Agency scrutiny, remains peaceful, while Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi ruled out direct U.S. talks under ongoing coercion, despite Trump's recent two-month ultimatum for negotiations or military consequences. Iran continues engaging with other JCPOA signatories, rejecting US's efforts to broaden the deal to favor Israeli interests, with Kamalvandi arguing Western pressure only backfires. Trump's renewed push, including a letter this month, was branded deceptive by Iran, which doubts US reliability and asserts its sovereign right to its foreign policy, setting the stage for a tense diplomatic standoff.
And to West Africa, where last week Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger declared their exit from the International Organization of la Francophonie, OIF, labeling it a French neocolonial tool that undermines their sovereignty through sanctions after ousting France-backed regimes from 2020 to 2023. Founding members since 1970, the trio, now united as the Alliance for Sahel States, AES, criticized the OIF for punishing their anti-imperialist shifts, including expelling French troops rather than supporting the people's goals, with the withdrawal effective in 6 months, reducing the OIF's 93-member bloc. The move follows their January exit from ECOWAS, halving its reach, and reflects a broader rejection of Western influence, exemplified by Mali's demotion of French as an official language in 2023. OIF's Van de Wege lamented the decision's impact on projects, but the AES sees it as a step towards autonomy, weakening France's grip as anti-colonial sentiment surges across the Sahel.
Into the United States, where the 2024 Stockholm International Peace Research Institute report was released last week and shows that the US and NATO allies command over 80% of global arms exports from the years 2020 to 2024, with the US at 43%, up 21%, supplying 107 countries, driven by Ukraine's 9% import share, and 45% of that was from the US alone. NATO's dominance, with France and Germany in the top five, overshadows Russia's drop from 22% to 7.8% due to sanctions and war needs, while Europe's imports soared 155% amid Trump's push for NATO spending hikes, now targeting 5%. Asia and Oceania, down to 33%, remain top buyers, with India second globally, while the Middle East's 27% share includes Qatar and Saudi Arabia in the top 10. The report reveals NATO and allies like South Korea and Israel dwarfing non-aligned exporters like China and Iran, cementing Western control over a conflict-driven arms market.
And finally, to Palestine, where the Yemeni armed forces announced a major escalation in their military operations against Israel and the United States, launching ballistic missile strikes on Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport and targeting the USS Harry S. Truman aircraft carrier in the Red Sea. Military spokesman Brigadier General Yahya Sari stated that the attacks were carried out in solidarity with Gaza in response to ongoing US-backed Israeli aggression. In a televised statement, Sari reveals that Yemen's missile force fired two advanced ballistic missiles, including a hypersonic Palestine 2 missile supplied by Iran, at the Ben-Gurion airport, marking one of the deepest strikes into Israeli territory since Yemen joins the conflict. He also confirmed a second wave of attacks on U.S. warships involving cruise missiles and drones following American airstrikes on Yemen earlier this week. The escalation comes after U.S. warplanes bombed a cancer hospital in Saada province, an attack condemned by Yemeni authorities as a war crime. The Yemeni Cancer Control Fund accused Washington of systematically targeting medical facilities and called for urgent U.N. intervention. Meanwhile, the U.S. military confirmed continuous operations in Yemen, including a recent strike that killed 53 people, the deadliest since President Trump returned to office. Yemen had previously paused its Red Sea blockade after a ceasefire agreement, but resumed operations last week, citing Israel's blockade of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Sari votes that Yemeni armed forces would continue the military campaign until Israel's siege on Gaza is lifted and the aggression ends. The U.S. has responded by deploying the USS Carl Vinson to the region, signaling a potential further escalation in the conflict. And those have been the news headlines for this Wednesday, the 26th of March.
Although we should perhaps also just quickly mention that the budget came out last night, and I think that's enough that we need to say about it.
Yeah, the budget's out. There's an election coming up. Yep. And nothing changes.
And yeah. Nothing changes. Yep. It really... I had a quick look through the age, and yeah, there'll be... Especially if you're on welfare, there's... Nothing changes except for the price of things.
Mm. Things even get worse, you could argue. Well,
yes. Yeah, certainly. Indeed.
Rich get richer.
Let's go to an announcement and then we'll go into our first story.
Yep.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Are you stressed about your home loan? Right now, more Victorians than ever are stressed about home loan repayments. If you're going through a period of temporary financial hardship, you can ask your lender for hardship assistance. Lenders can agree to reduce your interest rate, extend the term of your loan, freeze interest, put a temporary hold on payments, or reduce your payments. If you only own one property that you live in, and either you are affected by family violence or your household earnings are less than $75,000, contact Mortgage Stress Victoria for free help from a lawyer, social worker, or financial counsellor on 1800 572 292 or www.mortgagestress.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Good morning. You're on Wednesday Breakfast, and today is the 26th of March 2025. We have just finished reading the news headlines in case you missed those. And now we move on to our first segment, which is a segment in which we will play a conversation that I had last week with Uncle Robbie Bunjalini-Thorpe, who will be well known to our listeners. And we had this conversation on one of Uncle Robbie's show, Bunjil's Fire. And this conversation is about treaty and is really illuminating, I think, because it gets to the heart of why the treaty process by the so-called Government of Victoria falls short on so many levels, being full of obfuscations, omissions and contradictions as it is, with some major issues being that it is a state-led piece of colonial legislation. It fails to meet an international standard, and it's not being conducted in good faith, with a choreographed process featuring cherry-picked representatives and predetermined terms of reference. So in brief, it appears that the state of Victoria is attempting to push through an illegitimate treaty in order to legitimize its illegal occupation of this land. And the sovereigns of the land see right through it. So let's have a listen. Bring it back home.
Yeah, right on 11:30, I'm back with Nita, which our plan was to have a yarn about treaty, but I thought it was important to have that bit of an update because he's always on the move. I've got to grab him when I can. Thanks for putting up with that.
Love to hear, Len, always. That was really important to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually leads nicely into our discussion because, yeah, I think these are the contradictions in this whole process.
Yes.
And yeah, it's sort of for me, I think, yeah, a lot of questions sort of came up because I got something in my mailbox that, you know, sort of just says treaty, clearly branded with, you know, State of Victoria, you know, very much, yeah, come from it. And I think there's an information session at the, I think at Tim Reid's office down in Brunswick, who's the MP for the area. And it's sort of like, wow, this is really looking very, you know, I guess heavily state led with no inference to anything to do, at least I could see in that flyer, with you know, Aboriginal people or involvement other than the art on the flyer, you know, stuff like that, where you're like,
exactly,
it's time to ask some questions.
It's a treaty for Victoria. Who's Victoria? You know, wasn't it a treaty for the Japwarang or the Gunai or the Kulin or the treaty under Bunjil or Boran or Wunjil? You know, why are we, putting her name there in history where it should be? She's a criminal, as far as I'm concerned. Why are we entrenching her name in history, which should be called something else other than a treaty for Victoria? It's really disturbing me, that thing for a start.
So, yeah, absolutely. It's like, in a sense, yeah, treaty should be questioning these things, but it's actually sealing it in, right? The fact that it's called Victoria, why? Yeah.
Why,
yes. Yeah, so I guess many questions come up, and I really, I was just thinking, yeah, about asking a few questions to you, but also thought it would be, I think a lot of people have these questions, you know, and one of the So it's really amazing to be here. Thank you for having me on your show.
That's my pleasure.
Where did the initial idea of treaty come from, and a treaty for Victoria, really?
Well, the idea of treaty's been around for a long time, generally. You've heard the song from Yoffa Yindi. My uncle wrote up a thing called the Sovereign Treaty years ago. The idea of treaty's been around, sort of got forgotten about there for a while. And whilst these the dialogues for the constitutional inclusion and came around, which was a federal initiative to get us into the federal constitution, they had these dialogue meetings, and they came to Melbourne, and there was a large gathering of Aboriginal people from around the state of Victoria, inverted commas, state. I hate the idea of the word Victoria. It's not the name of this country. Anyway, we had a meeting around there, around that dialogue around the constitutional inclusion, and we rejected it. And the question was asked, well, what do you want? And someone got up and said, we'll have treaty justice first. It wasn't in relationship to the Victorian government. It was in relationship to that federal constitutional inclusion business, just prior to the Uluru gathering they had there, it's connected to that, not the state business. So that's where it came from. I think it was held down at Fed Square. It was a statewide meeting of Aboriginal people. That's where they said, no, we'd rather do treaty business first.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't in relationship to the state. They assumed authority and responsibility, and no one asked them.
Mm.
So that's still an issue for me.
Yeah, so I guess that's really maybe my next question, which is, in a sense, treaty business first, treaty justice, I imagine was referring to we want justice on this continent for this occupation before, all the other little plays like constitution recognition. But then Victoria, the state of Victoria, so-called, suddenly has this treaty for Victoria. So I guess, you have to ask the question, what are the intentions of the Victorian state in taking this, interpreting it in that way and taking it on?
I think they seen the writing on the wall that the Aboriginal people weren't going to be a part of the, their plan was to assimilate us into their constitution. So the state government said, no, well we better do something about this situation. And they took it upon themselves to take on the treaty business. Nobody asked them.
Mm.
They went on to write the terms and reference for what a treaty would be, and basically appointed the people who would sit at the table to do that. And that's really offensive and insulting for me, for that to happen. And we're not interested in a state, a Victorian colonial state legislation, which is what it is.
Mm.
So, that's, they're trying to undermine the real issue of treaty. We're talking about international law here,
mm-hmm.
not a colonial legislation, state colonial. We're talking about international law. And they know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
What it does is it exposes Australia for what's real history, and I think it takes it to task. I think they're very afraid to go to the international court. They just can't accept that sort of jurisdiction. So they've just tried to undermine us the whole time. And it's reflected in the way that this treaty's been created up to this point. It's not really a treaty. It's state government legislation.
Mm.
So.
Okay, sort of like little band-aid to, hide the injustice to some extent, and also provide a smokescreen to keep going, to look good and keep basically just going on with business as usual. I mean, the fact that they wrote the terms of reference and they're appointing their representatives, it's very backward from the intention, of course, that I imagine any Aboriginal people would have with regards to treaty, any normal person would have. It's that they're setting the agenda fully. They're setting these terms of reference and the representation
to get the results they want.
To get the results they want at the end of the day. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, they're basically just stacking the table the way that they want it and then pushing through their original ideas until the very end.
I'll just add to that. Most of the average people who do work for the state
mm-hmm.
or a corporation that's funded by the state. There's a group of people who have claimed unceded sovereignty. We're the ones who have been pushing these ideas. Now that the corporate gravy trains hit the brick wall, they're turning around and grabbing hold of the campaigns that we've been running, undermine them, and selling them out. So that's what's sort of happening, and it's really offensive and insulting.
Mm-hmm.
So if that makes any sense.
But
that's what's sort of happening, and we need to turn that around. It's been a bit of a gamble because mm-hmm. at the same time, our young people are learning a lot about treaty, where they didn't know about this before, which is a dangerous situation. They've got control of the treaty assembly. It's like they're entitled and to this, but that's not how Aboriginal law works. Aboriginal law is governed by the elders,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't got our elders sitting in council. We're not independent. So that for any proper treaty process to happen for me, we need our elders to be resourced properly informed and in a position to negotiate something like that.
Mm.
But the elders have been an afterthought in terms of this treaty process, and just treated like the corporations have been treating us. The corporations are unaccountable to Aboriginal people and they're misrepresentative. In fact, it's a huge fraud on which the whole this cultural heritage is based on, and also native title,
mm.
a huge fraud. Now, that's white man's law.
Mm.
Now, there's no inkling of our law being sitting at the table, in a sense. So until that happens, it's not a treaty for me.
Mm.
And a lot of other people agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And so is it for the what is the representation, in quotes, of Aboriginal people look like at these treaty assemblies that are being put forward by the Victorian state? Is it these corporations?
In the main, yes.
Yeah, in the main.
They're setting the agendas.
Mm.
And they're deciding who gets a say.
Yeah.
I was involved. I was one of the people who mentioned the idea of a treaty back in, I think it was 2015. I was never invited to a meeting.
Mm.
I've been working around those issues of treaty. We talked about the issue the Black GST, which is issues of genocide, sovereignty, and lack of a treaty.
Mm.
Not that we really wanted one. We're just saying you haven't got one, mm-hmm. Australia. Mm-hmm. You haven't got consent. You haven't got jurisdiction. So, not being asked to be involved, I'm basically an elder now who spent my life talking about these issues. You don't get invited. Gives you an idea of how the state operates and cuts out a lot of people. Even the voice business, they made sure that certain voices weren't to be heard.
Right.
So, it's how they operate.
Yeah.
So we're going to break that and we need to go to the international court. There's treaty standards of international law. That's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Not some sort of Mickey Mouse. I call it the Mickey Mouse Mumba Treaty here. That's rubbish and it's insulting and offensive. We want to go to the international court and work on those standards. Yes, yes. That's why people like myself, I won't work with Aboriginal organisations. It's totally counterproductive. It's not self-determination.
Yeah.
They're not community controlled, all the organisations, like they were set up as they've been taken over and incorporated. And once you incorporate, you're working under a different law.
Mm.
So it hasn't worked. So, we're not ready for a treaty. It's very premature, this talk about a Victorian treaty. Some of the other states tried it, but they've dropped it, Northern Territory and Queensland. They've dropped out of the idea of treaty business. So it's interesting that Victoria, remembering that Victoria is the premier state, and it's where the original constitution come from in this country.
Mm.
All came out of here. It's where their law is premised. So it's interesting that They're still holding on to this idea of treaty business. So.
Why was it dropped in the other states? What happened there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd have to look at exactly why, but I think they just took it on as a, entertain Aboriginal people and get around a few things. And then when they got the opportunity, they dropped it off. Mm. The Northern Territory treaty business has been going for quite some time. That was interesting that they dropped that off.
Mm.
So a treaty business overrides the idea of native title, which is white fella law. I think they describe native title as the most lowly form of entitlement in the country. In fact, it's less than pastoral lease, and a pastoral lease is for foreign white animals, hardly a just resolution of what's happened to Aboriginal people. Replace terra nullis as the foundation. I think terra nullis is probably better. We weren't sort of locked into their system where native title is attempted to do that.
Mm.
A lot of people actually rejected the whole idea of native title, like us here in Victoria. So now we never see their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issues that they're the levels that we want to be negotiating our treaty business,
mm-hmm.
our sovereign position, not any other way place, not government corporate bodies and their funding that's managing and controlling the process. It's got to be something different.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that we haven't got a treaty, I don't really believe in the idea of treaty unless it's on our terms and reference and conditions. It's the only way it can be, and it's got to, when you do treaties, it's got to be, it's about two laws and creating a proper, creating a basis of coexistence. And they're not thinking that. There's their way or the highway sort of thing. And I don't know if it's a good idea that we're even talking about treaties. It's because they're just skipping over the real issues. It's, they've decided the terms of reference and condition. Certain things you can't talk about. And that's not how it works. Everything's got to be on the table here. We're talking about generations of injustice, genocide, crimes against humanity, all those things, resource theft. What are we actually talking about? And our rights to live in this country and be able to gather our own food, as the case with the Cruz brothers and the abalone, and right across this country. This is our garden. We created it. We haven't got access to it anymore for some reason. So there's a long way to go. Anyway.
Yeah, there's so much there. And, you think about even the royal commissions that were, put forward by the state itself, haven't implemented those recommendations, increasing the removal of children. Like, that's not even being done. How is meant to believe that, they're serious about treaty, the way the whole, voice referendum was conducted, which with all that's, lies and obfuscations, how are we meant to believe that this is, absolutely. It's like, show something real and then maybe we can start to even try to believe that maybe something's changing.
Well, maybe one idea for that, to see some worth in the whole process is, why don't they have an end of hostilities, an official end of hostilities with an admission of what's happened, go from there. So it really needs to have an education program to go alongside this, because Australia's totally ignorant about the real issues in this country. Mm. Who knows anything about it?
Mm.
They're either totally ignorant, in denial, or just racist. And that's what it is. So it needs an education program. It needs to start at the kindergarten level right through. So, we're not facing all these problems, and it can be a proper negotiation. In fact, if you don't have that program, I don't think we should be talking about treaties, because it's putting us in danger in a sense as well. But I really believe we need to have an end of hostilities. So unless you see that first, it's not really a treaty. It's just more the same British colonial legislation or colonial legislation. It's not going to fix it up. It needs to be done properly. Treaty at international law, at the very minimum.
So going to the international court could look like what might eventually be a first step in terms of even recognizing that there are these hostilities, you know, by international law, and being a starting point to continue on having conversations from there.
I'd like it to be scrutinised at international law. You know, we know we can't get any justice in this in this country. You just heard from Len about how they got it all configured, how we don't ever get to see justice. We've got to go through all this mire of, you know, all that rubbish. It takes a long time to unwind all that and get to the point, you know. And then try to explain that to the wider community. It's very difficult. So there's a long way to go on all this. But, you know, we're not going anywhere. We want to get this right. We've got our children's children to be considering. We don't want to dishonour our ancestors. Mm. They never gave up nothing. Our esteemed elders. Mm. It's just the assimilated, incorporated blacks in this little bubble here right now. They're doing a lot of damage. So, they're not going to get it right.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to do a treaty, get it right. Otherwise, we don't want it.
Absolutely. Yeah. All that loss can have been, for nothing. So, carrying on the struggle. Well, I think then, that's what...
I don't know if that explained much to you.
It did. It explained everything to me, yeah. I think just supporting, the real struggle, and I think the struggle to international courts and just the grassroots struggle is where energy and time is best spent instead of legitimizing this, the genocidal state, basically. So, it's very clear. I've been listening, actually, to you and Len a lot talking about this. So,
We've been on our own too. Like, we don't get any support. You know, we've got $1 billion annual funding for our legal services in this country. They're not arguing about our legal rights. They're providing a service under their system. And we end up being the most jailed people on earth. They never argue the question about where the jurisdiction comes from. Our basic and fundamental human rights being denied in this country. It's never a factor in the court hearings. Australia's been at it for, denying our rights for 250 years here. Australia's out of sight, out of mind. They've been able to get away with lots in terms of basically trying to exterminate, wipe us off the face of the earth. It's incredible that we're even here with anything, any spirit and fight and resistance. It's taken a lot to even get to those points and... So we don't let it go. I believe in a treaty at some stage. We need a basis of coexistence in this country. It's got to be done properly, though. And, you know, Australia probably needs a treaty more than we do to justify their occupation.
Yeah.
You know, it's an illegal occupation as far as I'm concerned. There's been genocide going on the whole time. All right. Well, thanks, Nita. Do you want to add?
What a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
And what a pleasure for you to be on my show. Thank you so much.
And we've just been listening to Uncle Robbie Bunjalini Thorpe on a segment on Bunjil's Fire, speaking about the treaty process that's being undertaken by the so-called government of Victoria, which is illegitimate in numerous ways, and we need to understand I suppose also talk about it to people in this state, and also to center Aboriginal leaders and voices, really call for an end of hostilities that looks like decarceration and stop the removal of children. Uncle Robbie also reiterates that treaty needs to be continent-wide instead of a colonial piece of state legislation, needs to be done properly at the international level where everything is on the agenda instead of the cherry-picked terms of reference and cherry-picked representatives. You can listen to Bunjil's Fire every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on 3CR. Next up, we'll play a song, Treaty, by Yothu Yindi. And that was Treaty by Yothu Yindi, really well-known song calling for a legitimate form of treaty. It's 7:42 a.m. and you're on 3CR Wednesday Breakfast. We just listened to a segment in Treaty. And next up.
Well, actually, I think we might go to an announcement first, and then we'll be talking with Bob Price, who's on the line from America. So let's have more Robbie Thorpe, because you cannot have enough Uncle Robbie Thorpe.
You really can't.
My name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website, 3cr.org.au, or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well, by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
And you're listening to 3CR, 855 AM. It's Wednesday, the 26th of March. And on the line now, I've got calling in from the United States. I've got Bob Price from the Freedom Socialist Party. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Bob.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Sonia.
Now, we think that we've got interesting things happening here in Australia. How are things in the States at the moment?
Well, things are constantly being kept in a state of confusion in terms of what the president is going to do next, but people are pretty determined to resist a lot of the draconian things that are coming down. We see protests on a weekly basis at Tesla dealers, and people are going out into the streets to protest the deportation. Well, not the attempt at the beginnings of the process to deport Mr. Khalil, Mahmoud Khalil.
Yep, the Columbia University student.
And to defend immigrants in general.
Mm. And do you think that this is part of a broad movement, or is it just a reaction to things deteriorating at the moment?
I think it's, you know, there's a combination, but a lot of it is people. There has been a movement, you know, there's always a movement of resistance here. I do think it's both from the center left all the way over to the left, people are going out and organizing. I mean, unions are getting stronger, and unions are gearing up for May Day. So I see it more as a movement toward more organizing.
That's good to hear, because we don't hear that side of things in the news over here. Now, that was a bit of a curveball question from me, I'm afraid, because that's not the real reason that we've got you here to talk about. I'd really like to talk about is the book that you've published, Cuba, A Socialist Dream Deferred. Can you just perhaps summarise the main arguments for our listeners?
Yes, this is a book. I mean, as you said, I'm from the Freedom Socialist Party, and we have long supported, the right of Cuba to exist and to be a socialist country. And from the very beginning of the times of the revolution, that brought many gains over what had been in the past in Cuba. We've been strong defenders of it and against the U.S. blockade. But we are very disappointed about the course that the Communist Party of Cuba has taken in the last many years, away from a socialist society and system, and more re-implementing capitalist ways of doing things in the island, on the island, I should say. To the point where it's, so much money that is spent by the government is spent for the tourist trade to build up the hotels when tourism is actually down, and people in the meantime are experiencing starvation, poor public services, inability to really protest in a major way, even though there are some protests that have broken out. Our main analysis is that Cuba was on the road to socialism, but over time, it has, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Carry on.
Maybe you should ask the question.
I was just going to say, in the book, you talk about some of the things that were drivers towards capitalism and the reasons why that shift away from.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
From the path towards socialism might have occurred. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. Cuba, you know, had been part of the bloc that was trading with the USS, traded with the East Bloc, with the Soviet Bloc when that was in power and still existed up into the late 80s, around 1990. And then, you know, with the loss of the fall of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc, Cuba lost a lot of its trading partners. And that was a large basis for its economy. So it had to turn to tourism and other means to bring capital into the country in order to buy the food and other necessities that the population needs for a period. I was there in 2010, for example, and there was a lot of trade at that time and support from Venezuela because Cuba would send doctors to Venezuela and in return get oil and many products but especially in the energy sector, you know, a lot of oil was received from the Venezuelans, and so that was a great boon to Cuba. But then when you know, Venezuela went through its crisis and the pandemic came along, all they had left as a source for income internationally was tourism, and then, you know, the pandemic ruined that. So Cuba has had to, I mean, over the years, more and more the Cuban government, the Communist Party of Cuba, has put in what were meant to be temporary measures to allow little bits of capitalism, but more and more they've given up on making it a little bit and toward making the society a capitalist one in more of a permanent sense, such as the direction that China has gone and Vietnam has gone over the last 25 years or so. We see Cuba going in that same direction, although Cuba comes from a situation where there's very little wealth, and what little wealth there is now being concentrated more and more in the hands of the Communist Party leadership and the military, and then also with some foreign capital, some foreign businesses coming in as well. So
I can't help but think of capitalism as this in metaphor as a sort of cancer that as soon as you give it a foothold, it just spreads everywhere without control, rapaciously devouring everything in its path.
Yes. And then, you know, we come from the part of socialism known as Trotskyism, mm-hmm. Where that means we're different from what we didn't agree with the change in the USSR under Stalin, and what that Stalinism believed that you could have socialism alongside capitalism and that you could have socialism in one country. So what that would lead to is making deals with capitalists And in Cuba, when the Cuban Revolution first happened, and, you know, the only people in the world that they could trade with once the capitalists stopped, you know, put restrictions on them, especially the U.S., was the Soviet Union. And so they have that legacy of Stalinism built right into their form of socialism from the start. And the belief that they could have socialism in one island and not have to be able to resist capitalism and to stand up to it on their own. You know, it used to be that Cuba would fight for other revolutions like they did in Angola, but more recently, you know, in Latin America, when there were revolutionary movements in Venezuela and El Salvador and Nicaragua, the Cubans would advise them, don't do what we did and nationalize everything. And, you know, that by doing that, they were cutting off possible revolutions that they could be in alliance with to move more and more countries toward a socialist kind of society. So,
now, can you talk a little bit about the groups which are resisting the move towards capitalism within Cuba itself?
Yes, I mean, there's a group, it's very hard to resist in Cuba, first of all, because other parties are not allowed, and criticism of the Communist Party of Cuba is publicly not allowed. I was just reading a report on from I think March 18th, where a young man was arrested for just holding a sign by a statue in Havana saying "How long?" The police came and arrested him for his peaceful, nonviolent demonstration. So it's a very difficult thing. But what gave us hope? I wrote this pamphlet for our convention of 2022. One thing that gave us hope is that there are different groups of people who want socialism still. And you know, there's a large segment of the population. The problem is being able to organize that. And there is a group called Comunistas Cuba, and you can read their works on comunistascuba.org. They're very small, but they're a group of determined individuals who want to put out a critique of what's happening with the government and push for staying on the revolutionary and socialist path.
And how much influence are they having in terms of the development of things in Cuba? I mean, obviously, there are those major challenges that you did mention. But are they?
Yeah, I mean, they're getting word out, but it's really hard for people to go out into the streets and resist. I mean, the last major demonstrations that I know of that are mentioned in the book are in 2021, when people went out in July of 2021, and then again in September, October. It was really more October 2022 because of the blackouts that happened after a hurricane.
And could you just explain, explain why the blackouts were a cause of people coming out?
Yeah. After this hurricane happened, the government, instead of, focusing on helping people in the west of the island where there was the hurricane, they were going after protesters in other places. And well, your question that really goes to why did people go out? Well, for a Cuban, with the impoverishment of the island and the very low wages that people have, people save months and months for food, and then so they buy it and they store it up and they keep it in the refrigerators or maybe in some cases even freezers. So when the power goes off and isn't restarted for a long time, they lose, you know, savings of months and months and months of labor that they put in saving that money up. And so it's just it just adds insult to the injury of, you know, the lack of services and the inability to get good food that there already is, on top of it, you had a blackout, and it just sends people out into the streets.
Yeah, I thought that was a really stark image that, you know, that people have so little that they store their wealth in terms of food, which is so vulnerable to these blackouts and to these natural disasters. And yeah, I thought that that was a very powerful image of the poverty and the conditions that they're facing.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I mean, and that kind of resistance was amazing. I mean, it was mainly led by women, you know, who have increasingly had burdens put on them as the economy has gotten worse and worse. And, you know, and as there's been a reversion from pushing for women to be out in the workforce more, you know, along with the incursion of capitalism comes the idea that, you know, of the nuclear family, women being back in the household and providing for the family and taking care of the food and all those things. Whereas earlier in the revolution, there were, you know, communal kitchens, there were lunches provided at workplaces and at schools, children's school uniforms were cleaned by, you know, it was all done collectively. It was done by, you know, with funds from the state. A lot of those things have been taken away as there's more and more capitalist measures being put in. And, you know, women have really borne a lot of the burden, an unfair share of it, as have Black Cubans. So.
I'm afraid that we're starting to run out of time. Could you just tell people where they could get a copy of your book? And also if there's any other ways in which they can find out more information about, particularly, I think, the current resistance that's going on in Cuba.
Yes, well, the book you can get at the Solidarity Salon of the Freedom Socialist Party in the Melbourne area at 113 Spring Street in Reservoir in Victoria. And as I said, a good source, one of the good sources I find of information from activists within Cuba is comunistascuba.org. A very good source of information, and
we can put that link in our show notes.
And in Australia, you have sometimes we'll have articles in our newspaper, the Freedom Socialist, that's published here in the U.S. and is sold also in Australia. But the people, the comrades that we have in Australia, put out the Freedom Socialist Organizer as well, and I recommend people check that out at the Solidarity Salon and in Reservoir.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us. Well, it's morning for us and lunchtime for you today. Although you're on yesterday, time is weird. But thank you very much for joining us, Bob.
I've enjoyed talking to you, Sonia. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye for now. And that was
bye-bye.
Bob Price, author of Cuba, A Socialist Dream Deferred, the first part of our show on Cuba today. Shortly we will be going to Sasha Gillies-Lukakis.
Sasha Gillies-Lukakis, exactly. And Sasha will help situate that conversation, actually. So previously we heard from Sasha, who were talking about right back, so from the Spanish colonization and the independence wars, of which there were a couple. And so we're picking up from there, and we're picking up in an exciting part because this is where Fidel Castro comes into the story.
I just say, I once saw Fidel Castro speak for 3 or 4 hours, I think he went at the World Conference Against Racism, and that was a huge honor to be able to be part of that audience.
That's crazy. That's amazing, Sonia. Very impressed. So we'll pick up from there. And so this is where the birth of independence in Cuba begun.
Great. Should we go to that now, or should we have an announcement first?
Yeah.
Let's have an announcement, and then we'll go straight into Sasha's interview after that.
Sounds good.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yillaman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
When this attack on the Moncada barracks failed in 1953, most people thought that this revolution was dead in the water. That was the widely held view when this happened, that, you know, this was such a poorly executed military operation, because it was, you know, there were about 60 people, and, you know, a lot of them, more than half, were killed in the operation itself, and the rest, including Fidel, Raul, they were taken prisoner. So, you know, the fact that after Fidel was released, and, you know, a large part of the reason why it became so popular was because Fidel gave his famous defense. You know, he defended himself with the very famous speech, "History Will Absolve Me." And this gained a lot of publicity, gave a lot of attention to his movement, to himself as a personality as well. And thankfully, I think the main thing that really helped them was the fact that they could then draw on all of these existing movements that had very, very deep roots in Cuba and that had very, very deep and experienced organizing capabilities. So, you, as I mentioned, the Central, the Workers' Federation, the trade union sort of organ that had existed in Cuba since the 1800s, you know, had a very, very long history, very, very robust membership, and they dedicated themselves fully to the M26 movement. You had the Communist Party, the Cuban Communist Party, which also dedicated itself fully and was quite a large party. It wasn't the largest. One of the bigger ones was called the Cuban Orthodox Party, which was also, it was a nationalist political party, didn't have the socialist bent, but, you know, it broadly agreed with a lot of what Fidel Castro was saying. So you had, you know, these quite significant political parties aligning behind Fidel Castro as well, which had their own organizing tradition, which had their own membership, which was quite extensive. And, you know, basically what was needed was an individual to draw them all together, which was Fidel Castro, you know, who was so articulate and, you know, often by sheer force of his personality was able to basically, you know, eliminate or overcome any differences, because there were differences, of course, between these groups, differences of opinion, differences in operation, but by sheer virtue of the leader he was and the military structure that they were then able to create within the M26 movement, because even though Castro was in jail, the M26 movement didn't stop its operations. They continued to organize. In fact, you know, Castro's legal case became a bit of a cause célèbre, you know, in Cuba. A lot of people joined because they were hearing about Fidel Castro and, you know, his legal struggles against what was widely perceived as a very, very corrupt and unfair system. So that itself also helped draw people to its banner. And you even had, you know, in some cases, there were still retired soldiers from, you know, the last war against Spain, 1895, and some of the generals from that time as well, who also lent their military expertise to the movement. That was a much smaller sort of case, but, you know, it just goes to show that it was a very, very unique blend of lots of different Cuban movements that allowed the M26 to become so successful with the policies that the new government implemented. I mean, from the outset, it became very clear that this was a serious movement, you know, that they were serious about the promises they had made, because they totally reversed, totally transformed Cuba's social structure, economic structure, you know, to the point where it was unrecognizable within 5 years. You were in a completely different country compared to the Batista era Cuba. To begin with, as I mentioned, from the economic side of things, you had the nationalization of all foreign-owned land. Now, you know, interestingly, because Castro did want a, you know, an amicable relationship with the United States, it's the country's largest neighbor, he initially did offer compensation for some of these companies, you know, as a sort of, you know, gesture of goodwill. But the US was so recalcitrant and so hostile that they wouldn't even accept that. The United States itself would not respond to Fidel Castro's calls and correspondence when this issue was concerned. So, of course, Fidel then said, well, okay, screw you. You know, said it in different language, but then, you know, he proceeded with a full nationalization of foreign-owned land. and the economic structure was aligned more with, you know, the model that had been implemented in other existing socialist countries at the time, the Soviet Union, the Eastern European countries, you know, that centered on the state-centric model, the statist model, with the exception of very small private property, you know, small shops, you know, small businesses, you know, literally at the unit of like a family business. Everything else was pretty much owned by the government. And, you know, this extended to agricultural land. The former plantations, sugar plantations, were reorganized around a collective model of production. So they weren't now owned by a landlord. It was state land that was communally governed, communally operated on. And, you know, the same went for all of these former companies that had left Cuba and left with their capital when they could. You know, basically the gaps that were left by all of these service providers, which were private and foreign for the most part, were basically filled by newly created state companies that the Cuban government created. And, you know, these companies could employ many, many more people than the private companies did, and generally provided very, very good conditions, not necessarily high wages. Of course, Cuba was a poor country, but, you know, they provided free creches at most workplaces that were, you know, built within the same building. You know, sick leave, you know, paid holidays of up to 3 months sometimes, depending on your job, for Cuban workers. So, you know, the model very, very quickly shifted to a, you know, a people-centric model, a socialist system. And the same can be said for education and healthcare, fully nationalized. They were made public, you know, entirely public services. So there was no more private institutions, no more Catholic institutions, which had been a big provider of services and which were notorious for their corruption as well, for embezzling a lot of the money that the Cuban government had given them prior to the revolution. And yeah, these were made public schools, well-funded. The Cuban government, of course, built many, many hundreds of more schools and many, many hundreds more clinics, particularly out in rural areas where there used to be very, very few. You know, many, many Cuban provinces didn't even have a hospital. You know, this, there was a hospital in Havana. Of course, there were a few hospitals in Havana. There was one or two in Santiago. But out in the provinces, apart from a few clinics, there was very, very little, even basic healthcare. So, you know, these were the two main pillars of the Cuban Revolution, expanding education. And this went up to university education as well, which, you know, this was the first time most Cubans could go to study at university. And then the other pillar was healthcare, you know, universalizing healthcare, implementing, again, like the Soviets had done, a preventative healthcare ethos. So, you know, expanding the network of doctors, creating the family doctor system, which is basically where there's one doctor for every neighborhood block. So that's how localized healthcare is in Cuba today, to make sure that there's, you know, there's detailed and personalized treatment and that the doctors know all of their patients. You know, to this day, I've interviewed some of these doctors. They'll go around every few months to talk with every single member of their neighborhood that they're assigned to, that they're responsible for, and take notes of health issues, of possible health issues, you know, possible factors that might influence these people's health. So there are literally books, you know, with the names of every person and their associated health problems. That's how extensive the healthcare network became. And, you know, this was funded in large part by those nationalizations of the property and the capital of the foreign companies. So we saw a total transformation, many, many new public works programs. You know, a lot of roads now are in quite poor condition because it's been some time since Cuba's had the money to basically modernize them. But a lot of, you know, the highways that you see that connect, there is now a highway that connects from one end of the island to the other. That was built by the revolutionary government. That didn't exist under Batista. And, you know, not really much rail, you know, railroad production or creation, just because, you know, Cuba's a very thin island, so it made more sense to operate a bus network, which became the main mode of public transport, a very extensive bus network. Again, sadly, in more recent times, that has been significantly reduced because of the fuel shortages, the economic crisis on the island. But back at the start of the revolution, for the first 30 years, this was a very, very cost-effective. In fact, it normally cost about 2 cents to travel, you know, throughout the entire city. For people like pensioners and young people, students, it was free. So, you know, fully subsidized, very extensive public transportation network, And then, of course, the other main, main transformation was in the realm of foreign policy, you know, beyond the domestic level. We had a very radical change in foreign policy, in large part, though, because the United States was so unceasingly hostile from the beginning. You know, once the revolution succeeded, the U.S. convened a meeting of the Organization of American States, which is widely regarded as, you know, the U.S.-backed organization in Latin America and the Americas at large. And they essentially got the entirety of the Americas, with the exception of Canada and Mexico, to sever relations with Cuba. So the entire continent had nothing to do with Cuba. There was virtually no trade. Thankfully, Canada and Mexico were different cases. Of course, Canada had back then a more dynamic foreign policy, particularly when concerned with Latin American countries. So they maintained an amicable relationship. They continued to trade. And Mexico, of course, which was itself a power in Latin America, it had had the Mexican Revolution already some decades previous to the Cuban Revolution. And even though it was already sinking, you know, a bit further towards the sort of neoliberal model, its foreign policy was still quite progressive at the time. So they opted to continue trading with Cuba and recognize the new Cuban government. But this left Cuba very isolated. So Cuba, of course, turned to the countries that were offering to help it in its time of need and engage with it and trade with it. And that was, of course, the Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries. And then later it would be the Asian socialist countries, China, Vietnam, Laos, North Korea, when they, you know, when they sort of became more interested in the Americas, which would take a few decades. But Cuba engaged very heavily with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union has been disparaged quite a lot when you know, there are historical discussions on the relationship between Cuba and Russia at the time. You know, the way that it tends to be portrayed in the West is that it was basically, you know, that Cuba just became dependent on the Soviet Union, that it basically replaced the United States. That is not the case. That's not what happened. The Soviet Union actually lost money in its relationship with Cuba because it was so understanding of the situation that the country found itself in. So it bought the entire annual proceeds of the Cuban sugar harvest every year at an inflated price. So it was paying more for the entire annual Cuban sugar harvest than Cuba would get with any other country. So the Soviet Union was losing money on its, you know, if we're talking in purely pragmatic terms, it was losing money due to this arrangement with Cuba. But of course, the Soviet Union wasn't looking to replace the United States as a colonial master. It was actually engaging with Cuba as a partner, you know, that it was looking to help Cuba finance all of these new social projects and these new economic transformations through buying the sugar, which, of course, Cuba had nothing else at the time. There was nothing that Cuba could do at that time to diversify its economy. Again, with the help of the Soviets, they then began to engage in mining, nickel mining, which is now something that is being explored in Cuba a bit more. And eventually Cuba would then branch out into medicine, you know, biopharmaceutical production, but that wouldn't happen again until the late 80s. So really, this was a lifeline for Cuba. And it was this relationship that ensured that, you know, the stores of food were fully stocked. Cuba's GDP and Cuba's like annual wage, average wage, was much, much higher than the Latin American average. It was among the highest in the Americas, with the exception, of course, of the United States, Canada. But it was higher than Mexico. GDP per capita was higher than Mexico during, you know, this part of the 20th century. So it showed, you know, that socialism was successful. And, you know, this insulated it from the sanctions, which the US implemented in 1961. That's when the embargo began. And it's been tightened, in some cases lessened, depending on the administration in the US, but never fully repealed. It's always been there. And it's had a crippling impact, you know, since the disappearance of the other socialist countries in Eastern Europe, that Cuba has felt ever since the 90s, you know, when this happened. But during, you know, from the 60s through to the 80s, really, you know, Cubans had anything they could ask for in the stores. You know, roads were being built, new clinics, wages were rising, living conditions had risen dramatically. And, you know, this is why so many people supported Fidel Castro. And, you know, this is why he was able to overcome, for example, the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, when the Cuban exiles, because about 500,000 Cubans left after the revolution, those wealthy landed elites and the commercial elite in Havana, and they then organized themselves with the backing of the CIA as militias, terrorist groups as well, and they returned to Cuba to try and overthrow the Cuban revolution. But of course, the people themselves fought against them, apprehended them on the beach. It was a total fiasco. And in the end, Castro and the Cuban armed forces, they captured these exiles and they traded them back to the United States in exchange for medicine and for food and for basic products. So, you know, there has since that time been an unceasing war waged against Cuba by the US beyond the sanctions, which crippled the economy. There have been, you know, successful attempts to introduce biological warfare against Cuba. You know, swine flu was introduced into Cuba. You know, other very, very dangerous toxins and pesticides deliberately flown over the island, flown over sugar plantations. During, you know, these early years as well, the CIA was financing domestic Cuban terrorist groups that had gone into hiding in the mountains, you know, former soldiers of Batista, who would go and, for example, kill teachers and doctors who were sent out into the rural areas. So, you know, callous, callous behavior. And then you had more extreme examples of terrorism. You know, you had Miami-based Cubans like Luis Posada Carriles blowing up planes. It was a very famous one where the Cuban Olympic team was on a plane that was blown up over Barbados by Cuban terrorists. You then had a hotel much more recently in the 90s that was blown up by Cuban terrorists, financed by the US and by the exiles themselves in Miami. So it has been a constant, constant war. It is, you know, people don't describe it as such, but for all intents and purposes, it has been a war against the people of Cuba and against the Cuban government. But, you know, as I mentioned, it is this unity that has allowed them to continue, you know, and, you know, Fidel Castro and since then, Raul Castro and now the new president, Díaz-Canel, have been very, very good at articulating the vision of the country. And, you know, that in spite of the difficulties that have emerged, you know, the economic difficulties, you know, the degradation in a lot of these services that were previously much more robust, you know, they are aware that these core pillars, you know, these education opportunities, these healthcare opportunities, you know, the social security net, which has also been eroded because of these, you know, crises, but it's still there. You know, they know that these things are something that the Cubans will lose if they turn back to some sort of neoliberal model. So, you know, it's been this unity of purpose and I think more importantly, an understanding of the context. You know, sadly, it's true that there is a greater percentage of Cubans now that are perhaps more willing to blame the Cuban government as opposed to this broader context of the blockade and, you know, the history of what the US has done and is doing. Because, of course, you know, after six decades, it's true, some people will get tired. And, you know, it's when you hear time after time, you know, it's the blockade, it's this that the US has done. You know, of course, you'll get frustrated because it's not something you can control. But generally, by and large, still a majority of Cubans, I can safely say this after having been so many times, are still behind the revolution and they understand, you know, that there is a context to all of these challenges and the economic crisis, and that they have survived worse. You know, as bad as it is today, the 1990s were much more difficult still. The special period was much, much more difficult. You know, now, for example, people, for example, can't get as much food in the basic, you know, food basket, food subsidy, which is called la canasta, like the little basket. But, you know, in the special period, sometimes there was no canasta for some months. So, you know, there's always something worse, but it is hard because, you know, some Cubans have grown up not knowing anything except these hardships. You know, people who are younger can't look back to the 60s and the 70s because they weren't there. Of course, there are still many Cubans alive who remember those times, but, you know, there is generally a unity in understanding and a unity behind the revolution.
And that was the third part of an interview with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis, incredible and knowledgeable person about all things Cuba, as we just heard, but also even more broadly around Latin America, providing context and historical context to the situation in Cuba. We'll go to a song now and then we'll return with some community event announcements. And that was the legendary Buena Vista Social Club with their song Chan Chan. Beautiful song to start off the Wednesday morning. I hope everyone's having a great morning so far.
You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM or streaming live on the Community Radio Listen app or podcast on 3cr.org.au.
Yes, hi to everyone in the future.
Absolutely, yeah. It's remarkable how many similarities Bossa Nova has with music from the Congo. I guess, you know, those historical links of the people really come through quite strongly. But on to some community announcements.
Yep.
Yes. So the big one that I have to share today is the Trans Day of Action, which is happening this Saturday. I've just lost it on my screen.
And there'll also be the Trans Day of Audibility Monday. Here
Sorry,
on 3CR.
Monday.
But yes, when...
Trans Day of Audibility. Sorry, the Trans Day of Action is on Monday, March 31st. Yeah. Yes, at the State Library, 5:30 p.m.
Today is a National Day of Action for Palestine called by the NTEU, the Tertiary Education Union. There will be things happening around lunchtime across campuses all across the country. So if you are a student or involved in the tertiary education sector, keep an eye out for things going on there, or have a look for notices up in your campus.
I don't have much else to share.
Okay, well, I will continue then. Tomorrow at 6:30 at the Resistance Centre on Swanson Street, level 5407 Swanson Street, there'll be a public forum on women's liberation and socialism. The speakers are Rohini Mohideen and Mary McKenich, so you could get along to that. There's also stuff happening at the Black Spark Cultural Centre. Tomorrow night at 6 p.m. there is Decolonization in a Time of Chaos, the inaugural event of Singing Blackbird Enterprise. So I'm not sure what that is, but that sounds like it'll be interesting.
I think it's I had a look. I think it was about they're a new collective based on songs and singing.
Nice.
And yeah.
And then on Saturday there'll be from At 1:30 p.m., a conversation on decolonization and Russia. I'm not sure who the speakers are going to be for that, but that's also at Black Spark Cultural Centre. And on Sunday at 4 p.m., there's the next in their series on understanding Palestine, which I assume is with Yusuf Al-Rumawi. Although on the notice that I'm looking at, it doesn't say. This weekend, there is, of course, the Geelong, is it called the Geelong Air Show? The great big weapons manufacturing thing.
Weapons festival.
So there's going to be a protest on Friday between 3 and 6 p.m., particularly targeting Miranda Engineering to stop weapons manufacturing. That will be on Melbourne Road, North Geelong. And I'm sure that there are other things happening in relation to the air show. But
that's probably all we have time for.
That is all we have time for. Oh, dear. Whoops. I had lost track of time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And next up is Stick Together.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.